This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Teenage house parties. For some high schoolers, they're something of a rite of passage, immortalized on television and in the movies. Take this scene, for instance, from the movie Superbad.
So you're coming to my party tonight, right? Because it's like fully on.
Yeah, why? Should I not come?
No, I want you to come. I just, you said something earlier about like a fake ID or something, right?
Yeah, I'm going to get one, for sure.
Can you get us booze?
Yeah, I can. I can get you guys alcohol.
Really? Seriously?
Yes, for sure.
Oh, that would be awesome. Thank you.
Well, that's the movies. But for parents, the underage drinking party can be a very real nightmare. One that's actually led to a series of legal cases, the most recent of which was just decided by the state's highest court.
And here are some facts from that case. In 2007, 19-year-old Jessica Simpson threw a party at her house in Wrentham while her father was out of town. Jessica invited friends, including 19-year-old Christopher Dunbar, who brought his girlfriend, 16-year-old Rachel Giuliano.
This was a BYOB party, so Christopher also brought a 30-pack of beer and a bottle of rum. And after drinking for a while, Rachel and Christopher got in a fight. Jessica, the party host, offered to drive the two home, but Christopher insisted that he drive.
Then the nightmare all parents fear came true. Christopher was driving at 96 miles per hour when he crashed the car into a utility pole. He was seriously injured, and Rachel suffered terrible brain damage.
Christopher Dunbar pleaded guilty to driving under the influence, but the case went much further.
Rachel's parents sued Jessica, the 19-year-old who threw the party, for negligence under what's known as the Massachusetts Social Host Law. They claim that by allowing her friends to bring alcohol and drink under her roof, Jessica, too, was liable for Rachel's catastrophic injuries.
And yesterday, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court issued its ruling. David Frank, reporter for the Massachusetts Lawyers Weekly, joins us now. David, how did the SJC rule?
Well, what the court did was really say that under the facts that were presented in the particular case that you just described, they held that the 19-year-old host of the party can't be held liable for the injuries unless the plaintiff could basically present evidence to show that she actually supplied alcohol to the guests at the party, or that she exercised some control over it. So it's not enough just to open your door and let some teenagers drink alcohol in your house. There has to be the actual supplying of the alcohol or some sort of meaningful step to make it available.
Which the court found in this case didn't apply because it was basically a BYOB party.
That's right. And if there was any evidence to suggest that the party host gave alcohol, or that some of the alcohol that was consumed came from her house, we'd be talking about a completely different outcome, I would think. But in this case, the evidence that the court took under consideration was strictly that this was a BYOB, and that all the alcohol that was consumed by the 19-year-old driver of the car was purchased somewhere other than the home.
Okay. So, David, this case actually raises a number of really important and compelling issues, and let's dig into them a little bit. I mean, first of all, it revolves around this criminal statute, the social hosting law, which in its actual wording seems somewhat vague. I mean, it prohibits, quote, the furnishing of alcohol, which means knowingly or intentionally supplying, giving, providing, or allowing a person to have alcohol on their property. It's been in effect in Massachusetts since the year 2000, and yet, if I understand correctly, in the multiple cases the SJC has heard about who's liable when a house party happens and underage drinkers consume alcohol, the court has been kind of reluctant to really expand the definition of the social hosting law.
And you're right, but what's really interesting here, and if you listen to the oral arguments that happened in this case a few months ago, the plaintiff in this case was really hammering that point home. One of the main arguments they made, I think pretty convincingly, was that the legislature saw fit to enact a criminal statute, a crime that punishes people who furnish alcohol to minors. But what the court did here was say that when you're looking at a criminal statute and you're then trying to use it in the context of a civil lawsuit, which is what this was all about, it's really an apples and oranges type analysis. So the court said that they weren't putting much value, if any, in the fact that there was a criminal law in the books that would seem to punish this kind of behavior. The court really said that if the legislature wanted a civil lawsuit to be able to proceed, they could have said so. They could have written a law that clearly said a person can bring a civil lawsuit seeking money damages if this type of injury happens. Because they didn't say that, the SJC said that they weren't going to write that kind of concept into the law.
That if that were to happen, it has to come from the legislature. David, let me ask you, how common are these cases in Massachusetts?
They're really common, and we write about them all the time here at Lawyers Weekly. And this is an evolving area of the law, and clearly there have been attempts in recent years to get the court to expand the theory of liability, to get the court to recognize additional sorts of lawsuits that can be filed. But to date, there haven't been any appellate decisions that have been willing to do that. And this one was really significant because if the court had come out the other way, you really would have been talking about almost an unprecedented expansion in Massachusetts. And what the Supreme Judicial Court said is that we're not willing to do that under this case. But there's certainly a lot of wiggle room. There's certainly the potential that another case down the road could be the one in which the court says we are willing to do that. But as far as this particular case, the court was not willing to grant that kind of an extension.
David, let me ask you, how does Massachusetts social host law compare with others around the country? I mean, we're not the only state that has it, but it seems like the SJC continuously rules in a way that puts some pretty strict limits around who's liable.
That's right. I mean, every state deals with this issue. This issue comes up in every state around the country. But it's, I believe, nine states in the country have actually recognized liability for injuries in parties where the host was underage. So there have only been a handful of states that have allowed a lawsuit like the one that the Supreme Judicial Court decided yesterday to move forward. So Massachusetts is actually in the majority when it comes to that. But there's no doubt that courts and judges here in Massachusetts have struggled with the concept in recent years. But to date, they have not been willing to sort of expand the class of cases for which an injured party can bring a lawsuit.
Well,
there are all kinds of reasons for that, but Massachusetts has been pretty consistent in not being willing to go that far.
And David Frank, let me ask you, I mean, one of the specific things about this case is that the plaintiffs were asking that an underage person, a minor, Jessica Simpson, who was 19 at the time, be the one who would be faced with the civil charges here. That obviously didn't happen. The SJC did not rule that way. But would things have been different if Jessica's father had been at home at the time? It seems like there have been other cases where a parent was present.
That's right. And that's the billion-dollar question. I think that, you know, one of the most interesting things of this case comes from Judge Gantz, Ralph Gantz, who wrote a concurring opinion. And he essentially is asking the court to limit its holding to cases involving an underage host. And he suggests very convincingly that if the SJC was faced with a fact pattern where the adult parent was home, that it would be a completely different analysis. And that really is sort of the next shoe to drop. There's no doubt that there are lawyers out there that are sort of teeing up the case to present to the SJC. And it's really just a question of when, not if, when the SJC will be asked to decide what they would do if the case involved an adult parent that's home. There have been cases where that type of argument's been made, but none sort of addressing the actual issue that the SJC dealt with yesterday in this opinion.
David Frank is a reporter with the Massachusetts Lawyers Weekly. David, thank you as always.
My pleasure.
Well, listeners, a lot to chew on there, and we're going to talk more about it, about the question of underage drinking and house parties, who's liable when teens decide to drink in a house, but more importantly, the question beyond the legal one, and that is, how do you as a family deal with this? So we want to hear from you. The law regarding so-called social hosting is not always clear, but what do you do in your family? What do you tell your teens? What do your teens tell you? Do you have an agreement on how to deal with situations where alcohol is present? And do you think parents should be held responsible if their kids throw parties while they are away? Should the kids be held responsible? Or how do we talk about alcohol? How do we raise teenagers to be the kind of adults where these situations don't even arise to begin with? Is that possible when alcohol is so prevalent in our society? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And joining us now are two people who know a lot about this subject. Dr. John Knight. He is the director of the Center for Adolescent Substance Abuse and Research at Children's Hospital in Boston. Dr. Knight, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Also with us is From Connecticut, I should say, is Dr. Barbara Greenberg, a clinical psychologist and teen doctor for Psychology Today. She's the author of Teenage as a Second Language, and she has a website, talkingteenage.com. Dr. Greenberg, welcome to you.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Knight, let me start with you. We just heard the details around this latest ruling from the Supreme Judicial Court. It's a really tragic story from Wrentham, but how common are these kind of stories of teenage drinking at house parties in Massachusetts?
They're all too common. So accidents are the leading cause of death nationally for teenagers in the United States, and that statistic has been true for several decades. Upwards of 35% can be directly related to the use of alcohol, particularly those that are involved with fatal motor vehicle crashes. When I say directly, that means that the person who is killed is intoxicated at the time of the crash. There are many more young people who themselves have not been drinking but are riding in cars with an intoxicated driver, which is at least partly the story that this involves.
I read a CDC study from 2009 that said they took a risk behavior survey amongst high school students, and they said in the past 30 days of the period of the study, 28% of high school students had ridden in a car where they knew the driver had been drinking alcohol.
That's correct. And in some of those circumstances, unfortunately, maybe as many as 30% of those cases, the person who's driving is a parent. So in terms of what parents can do, number one, parents can never provide alcohol to their teenage children at a party. National statistics show that 30% of parents do that. They provide alcohol to teenagers, taking away the car keys, mistakenly believing they can keep the teenagers safe in their home. It doesn't work. The other thing is parents have to understand that during the past decade, we now know that the human brain continues developing into the mid to late 20s. An adolescent brain does not handle alcohol the same way as a mature adult. So teenagers are at much greater risk from drinking alcohol. They tend to be more wide awake, yet just as impaired as an adult would be. So they don't get protected by getting sleepy and sitting around. They're active, mobile, drive cars, and they get killed.
Dr. Greenberg, I'm hearing Dr. Knight saying that parents are a major source of alcohol, first of all, for teens, and that, quite frankly, they shouldn't be giving it to them in any way, shape, or form. But is that realistic?
Well, that is one of the most fascinating conversations. That comes up on my website all the time. And here's what I think the bottom line is. I hear many parents saying, well, at least if my child is drinking under my roof, they're safe. And if their friends are here, I'll take the keys and I can monitor who's driving home safely. In fact, that sends the very wrong message. That sends the message that this is okay, drinking is okay. And frankly, kids whose parents allow them to drink at home are more likely to become the binge drinkers when they get to college. And secondly, I tell parents all the time, it is not their job to be their teen's friend. It's their job to be a parent. And sometimes that means having your child be angry at you, because safety should be number one. A lot of parents tell me, well, I don't want to give my child the impression that I don't trust him or her, but safety always supersedes trust.
Let me ask you, though, I mean, it seems like I can hear the voices of a lot of parents out there saying right now, well, if I make it taboo, even under my own roof, that may be the thing that encourages them to go into situations, house parties with friends where there is no adult supervision, and do the binge drinking.
Yes, and actually it doesn't work that way, because the most important thing is what parents role model. And if parents give their children the message in subtle and overt ways that they're not in favor of drinking, those kids are least likely to drink. There's a lot of data on it.
I agree. Mm-hmm. I think that parents need to give a clear message that drinking is unhealthy, and they should make themselves familiar with the latest science. It doesn't have to be a moral issue. They can tell their teenagers rightfully that they will damage their brains by drinking at this age, and it's better if they wait until they're adults.
Yes, I agree with you. And I think there's a very important overriding fact, and that's that even above legal responsibility, kids should be taught that they have a responsibility toward their friends. I've seen cases where kids have brought home a drunk friend, put that kid in bed, and the kid wake. I have actually heard about a story where a child has woken up dead the next day. Mm. Now, kids really need to learn that they're responsible for one another. And if they see one of their friends in trouble, they should contact an adult to help them. What I always love to tell the parents of teenagers is that they should develop a system where they have a code word with their teenagers so that if they're at a party and they're in trouble, they can call their parent and do something like, say, "Did I leave my jacket home?" And what that really means is, "Mom, come get me. Trouble here."
Let me ask both of you, Dr. Knight, I'll start with you. I completely take the point that what both of you are saying, that you establish ground rules, basically create an environment at home where attitudes towards alcohol are different. It was a while, but not that long ago since I was a teen, and I can very much remember the immense social pressures around teenagers and alcohol. It's one thing to say, we're building an environment at home, but they're spending a lot of time at friends' houses. They're in environments that you can't always control as parents, trips and whatnot. So how can a parent approach, these situations even before the child is in them? I mean, the kid's going to go to parties.
It's giving a clear and consistent message and giving it regularly that drinking alcohol is unsafe and unhealthy at your age. Now, having said that, I'm very aware of the national statistics. By senior year in high school, 70% of students will have taken a drink of alcohol. So parents will say to me, "Well, if we know that most of them are going to take a drink, why should we give them a message against it?" I say, "I know that my kids won't always do their homework, but I don't let down the bar. I don't say, okay, fine, don't do your homework. I keep the bar where it's supposed to be." And so I would give a clear message. Drinking is unhealthy. I expect you not to get involved in drinking, understanding, that they may violate that rule at some point, and I'll be there for them to keep them safe.
Dr. Greenberg, what happens when a party, a parent wants to go away for a weekend, and we're not talking about 12-year-olds, we're talking maybe 16, 17-year-olds, underage is technically below 21. The law apparently in Massachusetts is at least saying if the parent isn't there, they're not liable. But on the other hand, a parent kind of wants to be there to be an influence and a presence in social situations where their teens are involved, especially when it's under their own roof.
Right. So you want to sort of develop a message that you should be on your child's, figuratively, you should be on your child's shoulder, and they should hear your message. But I thought your point was so well taken about the peer pressure that they have. I remember there was one party in Germany where a teenager invited her friends to a party when her parents weren't home, and 1,000 kids showed up, and the party got really out of control. It's not a bad idea to let the neighbors know when you're going out of town, so they can kind of keep an eye on what's happening in your house. So this will bring up the whole issue of trust. And if your kids find out, they'll say that you don't trust them. Well, in fact, you don't want to say to your kids, "I don't trust you." But if you are totally trusting your 14, 15, or 16-year-old, then you kind of living in your own private Idaho.
I want to turn to our callers in just a second, but there's one more question I'd like to ask you, Dr. Knight. I was reading, there are cases all over Massachusetts that involve this social host law, and they raise a bunch of interesting issues. One recent survey came from Marblehead, for example, and it was a survey of parents and teens. And parents, in a way, demonstrated a certain blind spot when it came to the reality of alcohol in their teenagers' lives. Some 40% of parents said that they thought kids had binge drink in the past 30 days, but the true number coming from the teens was closer to 60%. I mean, is there a problem even in terms of the realistic nature or the realism that parents do or don't have regarding alcohol in teenage life?
I think, unfortunately, too many parents get separated from their children's lives because their own lives are so busy. Some of it may be wishful thinking, but you've got to be realistic with your children. They will be tempted. They will be in situations in high school where alcohol and drugs will be present, even if that's not by their own choice. And what we need to do is to prepare our children for those circumstances. I agree, having the code word is an excellent suggestion. There's also an instrument called the Contract for Life available from Students Against Destructive Decisions. It's on the web. This is a vehicle for parents and children to reach an agreement that should they be in a situation where there's alcohol at a party, the parents will give them a safe ride home.
Well, we have a lot of callers who want to join us. We're talking about the question of teenage drinking, house parties, and how parents and families should navigate around this issue of what to do when alcohol either enters your home or in a home where your teen might be attending a party. We're at 800-423-8255. Rocco writes on RadioBoston.org, "It's simple. Stop demonizing alcohol." He grew up in Italy and says the Italians don't have these problems because children learn to respect alcohol at a young age. That's one take. Let's go to Aaron, who's calling from Boston. You're on the air, Aaron.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I actually have something similar to share. Just wanted to shed some light on how I was raised. Definitely more in a European culture. My parents are like that. And I was able to have small glasses of wine with dinner starting in my early teens and potentially even before that. And I do have a respect for alcohol that I notice a lot of my friends don't have. And like I said, I was able to drink in the house, not allowed to go out afterwards, and no friends under the age of 21 were ever allowed to drink in my house with me. But, you know, I really respect the way that my parents raised me, and I'm really proud of the way that I can handle alcohol in relation to my friends at this point.
Aaron, thank you so much for your call. We'll pick that point up in just a moment, but let's go to Grace, who's calling from Cambridge first. You're on the air, Grace.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I would just like to say that I think part of the problem is that there, in many affluent suburbs, parents who have homes in other parts of New England and parents who are divorced, and those homes tend to be vacant a lot of weekends. There are often times when a child's mother thinks that they're at the father's house. The father is not home, and therefore the father's house is vacant, and there will be a party there. And similarly, parents go away to their winter chalets or their summer homes and leave their children, who are 14 and 16, home in their houses, and these unsupervised parties will take place. Now, we all realize if those children were 4 and 6, we would not leave the house. We would have someone staying with them, and maybe we should try to have parents working together so that if children are left, they are trying to have someone that would come and stay in their home.
Even as teenagers.
I think that is a beautiful
Grace, thank
point.
Grace, just a second. I'm sorry, Dr. Greenberg, but I just wanted to say thank you to Grace for the call. And, you know, sometimes I don't get as many callers in as I can, Dr. Greenberg, so I want to sneak in one more, and then I'll turn back to you and Dr. Knight. Let's go to Carlos, who's calling from Dorchester. You're on the air, Carlos.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, and I just wanted to agree with the previous caller. An awful lot of parents just assume that when the kids turn 14 and 15, that's time for them to go away and have a good time. And also, and that's definitely not the time to leave your kids home. But we raised two sons, one's 23, one's 10, one's 20. The 20-year-old treats his body like a temple, doesn't smoke, take any pollutants or anything like that. The other fellow enjoys life, and they change totally when they went off to college. Even though we try not to be the helicopter parents, we still try to stay within their life when they're at college. But as a parent, and we spoke to them about drugs and booze, and I come from a culture that, you know, there was always alcohol at the kitchen table.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw that as well. But when they go off to college, it seems to be every man and lady for themselves.
Carlos, thank you so much for your call. I think there's a bunch of interesting points here. And Dr. Greenberg, I'm sorry that I'd cut you off earlier, but you wanted to say about basically supervising teens even on weekends.
Oh, I thought that was a beautiful point, because a funny thing happens. When parents have their kids in the younger grades, they seem to be very close and there's a tight-knit community. When kids start driving, parents lose touch with each other, and that's a shame, because there's less of a community. And you know the expression, it takes a community to raise a child.
Mm-hmm.
I also wanted to make another point. I think that parents should be very aware that sleepovers, if they notice that their kids are going to sleepovers very frequently, they should keep an eye out for that, because kids often go to sleepovers so that they can get drunk and then go to somebody else's house to sleep so that their parents don't smell alcohol on their breath. So that is a really important fact, and I think parents should really be on the lookout for that.
Dr. Knight, there's been a lot of issues raised here. I wonder, I mean, again, I take the point that parents need to be parents to their children for as long as they're living under their roof. But honestly, I mean, our caller Grace was saying there are a lot of parents who, you know, maybe they don't live together, they want to go away for the weekend. How realistic is what you're asking in modern life?
Well, you can have neighbors or relatives check on your teenage children that are at home. You also need to make it very clear to them what your expectations are. The example that was given of 1,000 teens showing up at a party, that's happened many times in this country. I've seen it time after time because of electronic communications. A child left alone by parents might decide to invite two or three friends, but with Facebook and instant messaging, all of a sudden it turns into hundreds of kids who are showing up and bringing alcohol and drugs. Two points I'd like to make quickly. One is the idea of socializing teenagers to healthy social drinking when they're young. I've done a 180 on this. I used to believe that this could be a positive experience, but the emerging data suggests that there's no safe dose of ethanol for the developing teenage brain. That's right. So we don't know. And not knowing, I would say that children should not be given alcohol. But I do think that parents modeling the responsible use of alcohol is a healthy thing. The other is the urban myth that there are no problems in Europe. In fact, European youth have far more problems with alcohol than youth in the U.S. The rate in Italy that the caller cited is close to what it is in the U.S. But if you look at the northern European countries, France, England, Germany, and the Czech Republic, they have rates of drinking among young people and alcohol-related problems, including deaths, much higher than the U.S.
Well, there's a differing opinion there. I mean, I lived in London for a while, and the U.K. is its own data point, I have to say, in terms of what I saw on the streets there. But the issue is here in the United States and here in Massachusetts, a lot of legal cases, as David Frank a little earlier said, may soon end up at the SJC. Really interesting conversation. Dr. John Knight, director for the Center of Adolescent Substance Abuse Research at Children's Hospital. Thank you so much for joining us today. And Dr. Barbara Greenberg, clinical psychologist and teen doctor for Psychology Today and author of Teenage as a Second Language. Dr. Greenberg, thank you for your time as well.
A pleasure.
And listeners, let us know what you think. This is a major issue in every household I can imagine in Massachusetts. Would love to hear how you manage the question of alcohol and your teen. We're at radioboston.org. Stay with us. Up next, Sports with Bill Littlefield. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.